Hello and welcome to episode 84 of this little podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name, as always, is Perry Middlemas, and I'm here, as always, with my good friend David Grigg. Hello, David.
How are you, Perry?
Good, thank you. Counting down to the end of the year and all that fun problems that you have leading into Christmas, but I think we've pretty much got it organised this year. I've pretty much finished my Christmas shopping, which is good. We generally only have to pick up two or three. That's about it. And generally, my wife and I have decided what we're going to give the kids. It's normally one thing, and they might pick up a book or two. But otherwise, it's fairly simple, and then that's it. They're getting to an age where they don't really need much.
I've reached the point where I don't worry about what we give to my daughter. We worry about what we give to the grandchildren is the issue. They have to have presents. So that's
I don't have that problem.
Books are always a good standby. Books.
Yeah, well, they all sure are. The thing is, though, we always wanted to make sure when the kids were growing up that books were just sort of part of the general life currency. You know that if my wife and I went to a bookshop and we decided we want to buy a book, the kids got a book as well, so that it becomes sort of like, okay, this is just part of the general expenditure of life. You'll get some specifically good books for your Christmas and birthday, but on a, you know, monthly basis, not necessarily every month, but, you know, sort of 3-4 times a year, depending on how things go, you're down at a bookstore, you find you want to buy a book, so you buy a book for the kids as well.
Sure.
But, you know, the kids basically have the trouble of they ask me what I want and I just say nothing.
Well, I'm certainly that way this year.
I just got to the age where there's nothing I want except, you know, basically more of the same.
Yeah.
You know, give me some other books that I might want or... Anyway, David, I'll give you the hint. You'll get my best wishes, but that's about it.
Oh, that's all right. I wasn't expecting anything. Thank you.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. That's good, because that's exactly what you're going to get.
That's really good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that works out well. Anyway, so moving on into this particular episode, David, have you got any news for me?
I don't have any news as such, just to note that a number of organisations have been publishing their best of the year collections and things like that. That's about all I've got. Do you want to talk about that now, or we?
We can talk about a bit about those. I've got a few that there's so many of them, and a lot of them don't actually go to the idea of having a top one or even a top two.
No, there's usually about 10 or 12 or something.
Yeah. Well, 10 or 12, I think. Yeah. Crime Reads this year did the top 38.
Oh, good heavens, that's ridiculous.
So I'm not going to list all of those, but no. Goodreads.
Yes.
The book cataloguing platform that you and I both use, actually at the end of each year runs basically reader poll to determine what it is the favourite books for the readers for the year.
Yeah.
And they have done so again this year, and I can give you the, I'll just give you three categories.
All right.
Because they have heaps of them, but I'll just give you the three that are of particular interest to us. In the SF category, The Sea of Tranquility by Emily St. John Mandel, which I believe you read during the year and enjoyed.
Yep.
Fantasy, House of Sky and Breath by Sarah J. Maas. Not one that I've read.
No, I haven't read that either, but I noticed that I'm currently reading the book that came second on the list, which is Babel, An Arcane History.
Ah, yes.
Which is very interesting. I'm enjoying it so far.
Yes, I've seen that around as well. Seems to be getting some quite good notices, and I have it on my lazy, massively long to-be-read list. I've just put that over to the side and think, well, hopefully I can get to it. Sort of got the impression that it may well be in contention for a number of awards next year. Probably not a bad idea to get in front.
Sure. Well, I must say I'm enjoying it so far, and... But it's a very thick book, like all these things tend to be these days, but in fantasy. But it's good so far.
And the other one that I want to mention is The Crime and Mystery for Goodreads, which is The Maid by Nita Prowse. Prowse? Prowse. PROSE. Good name for an author, but it's not a book that I know.
Yeah, well, I talked about it on the podcast, if you recall.
No, I don't.
I do.
I don't remember you.
It won the Ned Best International Fiction on the Ned Kellys.
Oh, you were away.
That's why I talked about it when you were away, I think.
Oh, let's just say that's what happened, and that way it's getting it out.
I wouldn't have put it down as the best in the category this year. It's a nice read, but it's an easy to read, feel good sort of book, but it's not sort of hard edged crime fiction by my standards. But then you can.
Yeah, well, let's just remember here that this is a popular vote, so therefore you're going to get a level of popularity.
Yeah.
So you're going to get, depending on how people feel about things, they're going to generally go more towards the sort of slightly feel good end of the spectrum here. Yeah. I mean, they're not going to have massively hard cutting edge stuff. I don't think is a little bit difficult.
Yeah. And there's nothing else on the crime list that I've even heard of, let alone read. Oh, so.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So they're the three from Goodreads. Yeah. Now there's one other. The New York Times put out its best thrillers top 10, and two of them were sort of Irish Australian authors. Although one of them. Bit hard to tell. And I'll explain why in a minute. The Murder Rule by Dervla McTiernan, which we both read and talked about, which we thought was okay. Not up to her previous books, I didn't think.
No.
The New York Times thought it was in their top 10 thrillers. And the other one was The Island by Adrian McKinty, which you have read.
Yep.
I have sitting on a coffee table in the lounge room. It's been staring at me for months, and I have to try and get to it over summer.
It's a quick read. It's one of those books that grabs you and doesn't let go. You won't take long to read it.
All right.
It's good. Now, it's good, yeah.
I did say that they were both sort of Irish Australians, both having been born either in Ireland or Northern Ireland. Adrian McKinty lived here for about 10 or 12 years, but he's now firmly settled in New York, and I don't think that he'll be back. So I think we can basically say he's probably no longer considered to be an Irish Australian, just an Irish author, Irish American author now,
probably,
maybe.
Probably, I would say so. Mm.
There we are. Now, the last bit of news that I have for this time of year. Well, I'll talk about two awards, one that's been given and one that isn't quite been given just yet. And the first one is the Patrick White Award. The 2022 recipient of this was Antigone Kefala, who is an Australian poet of Greek Romanian descent. Now, the Patrick White Award is given out to people that the judges consider have done a lot of work over the years but haven't received the recognition that they really should have. Unfortunately, the recipient this year was given the award in November and died a week later.
Oh, goodness.
So that was rather unfortunate that she finally got a level of recognition and wasn't around long enough to appreciate it.
Enjoy it.
Mm. She was very well known as a poet, working in dealing with the immigrant experience in Australia, and had been a member of the literature board. So she was well known and obviously well regarded. Not somebody that I've read, but then, hey, so many people around that I haven't read that it, you know, boggles the mind, really. The other one that's in the news at the moment are the Prime Minister's Awards.
Ah.
Now, these are given out at the end of the year, and they seem to be getting pushed further and further back. There's been a lot of fuss regarding this particular award over the last couple of weeks, especially from Mark Robbo, who is the Managing Director of Readings Books, and also Peter Rose, who's the editor of the Australian Book Review, both coming out and saying that it's just way too late in the year.
Mm.
What people that hand these awards out have to realise is that for the vast number of people that are out there who are readers, they are totally and utterly swamped by all of the books that are out there and they're on offer, and they really don't know what to read. Not everybody is as assiduous as us, David, and reads all the book reviews all over the place and keeps an eye on things and talks about them all the time. A lot of people basically say, well, you know, if somebody's given an award like the Prime Minister's Literary Award, it's probably going to be a pretty damn good book, and therefore it's probably going to be a good one to give for a Christmas present. But if you're going to announce the award in mid-December, like 10 to 12 days before Christmas, it doesn't give anybody time to purchase them. It doesn't give the booksellers time to advertise them and put them out and make sure that everybody can see them and to get the actual copies in. Mm. Because sometimes these awards go to books that aren't really widely available. Mm. And in which case, you know, a bookseller like Readings down the street here with me in Hawthorne, they might only have one or two copies, but they might want 20. Mm. And there's no time to get them in. Mm. And so everybody's really bloody annoyed about it. The Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet says, oh, it all has to go with, you know, where the Prime Minister is and fit in with his schedule. Yeah, sure. But the number of times the Prime Minister actually turns up to give out these awards is really small. So it's not an excuse.
And I bet he doesn't read all the books either.
No, you could very easily give it out a month before in mid-November, and that would give 6 weeks and everybody time to actually get the stock in and make them available. So I'm with the critics on this. I think the Prime Minister's awards are an excellent idea, just at the wrong time of year, too late. Mm. Get them in a bit earlier. Put them up into mid-November and give everybody the chance to have a bit of a read of them and, you know, just fix it up.
I mean, sure.
Just a matter. And do you think public servants want to be handling this stuff in December? Mm-hmm. Most of them are going to Christmas functions all over the place and probably can't remember the name of the what that day of the week it is. So they're not going to be able to handle the awards properly. So fix it up. Right, that's my rant.
Oh, it was a good rant.
For this week. So that's really about it. So I think we should move on to our main topic for this particular episode, and that is that what we've been reading lately.
Indeed.
But before, just before we get into that, David, I have a quick question without notice for you.
Yeah.
How do you go about choosing the books that you're going to read when you don't have stupid people like me telling you you've got to read books for this particular podcast? Do you have any particular criteria for what you use for just pulling something off the shelf, going to the library?
Well, it's just that huge to be read list is just, you know, toppling, and so I just choose whatever's on the, you know, on the top of that and or the bottom of that, whichever you like to say, the book that's been there longest. And pick that up. And generally, at the moment, what I've been doing actually is going around my shelves here and pulling forward the hard copy books that I've bought relatively recently but haven't read. I mean, relatively recent, within the last year, but haven't yet read. And so it's like a dozen of those that I've sort of pulled out to read fairly soon. It's more difficult with the ebooks, and I tend to buy too many ebooks and never get around to reading them. But it tends to be just the most recent thing I've bought. But with the hard copy stuff, as I say, I've just been going through and pulling out a selection of those that I've bought but haven't yet read. So that's about
okay. I have a tendency to go through the bookshelves every now and again and just pull them out and pile them up and to put them up into piles. I'll get to these and I'll have a bit of a look at them and leave them in the pile. And my wife comes around and says, what are these doing here? And basically, she starts moving them around, shifting them into other piles, and then I get completely lost. They go, well, I better put them all back on again and then put them back on the shelf. And then a month or so later, come out with another pile. And then I go down to the library and...
Well, you see, that's the advantage of my approach I've just started doing, which is that they stay on the shelf. It's just that they're pulled forward to the front of the shelf, and so you can spot them, but they're in place. And so if you get to the stage where you think, no, I'm not going to read that, I'm just, you just push it back, and it works.
It's a very smart idea, but only works for those that are in the front. What happens if you've got...
Oh, well, I'm not like you.
You're
totally perverse. I mean, only perverse people stack books too deep on shelves.
I have to. I haven't got any room.
Well, you've got too many books then.
Ah, now you're starting to get to the rub of the matter. Yes, I definitely agree that this is the case. The paperbacks are okay because the paperbacks are on bookshelves that are only deep enough for just for the paperback, so that's okay. But the bigger ones, either the large format paperbacks or the hardcovers, are on a set of shelves which are actually deep enough, David, for me to get two in.
That's very, my shelf's not that deep, but it's a very cunning way of getting around my wife's rule of thou shalt not buy a new book unless there's room on the shelves for it. And rule number two, thou shalt not put up any more shelves.
Ah, yes. Well, I've got those rules in my house as well these days. But doesn't matter. The shelves are already full. I couldn't do anything about it. I just don't have any spare room.
No.
I just don't have any spare room.
No.
But there we go. Oh, but, you know, I do remember somebody telling me once about the concept of the infinite bookshelf, where what you do is you have a sort of, you find a room that's got walls that aren't all that far apart, and you put a shelf up which is exactly the width of the room, so it just stays there, and you wedge it in, and then you put your books on top of it, and you wedge them in so tight that when you pull the shelf out, the books stay there.
Hmm.
And therefore, you've got the difficulty then comes to the fact that if you want that particular book out of there, you pull it out, the whole lot comes down.
Yeah, but, that doesn't sound good.
I'm only giving you temporary solutions here.
I don't think that's going to work further.
Yeah. Okay, so going with that idea that you have a to-be-read list that, or a pile that you keep pulling things out, what's the first one of those that you've pulled out for us to talk about?
Oh, goodness me, what would be next after what I've currently got? It's a good question. It's probably one of Richard Powers's books, either The Overstory or... The Time of Our Seeing, which Bruce Gleason just put me onto, there. And in the ebooks, I'm looking forward to reading Her by a certain Gary Disher, which I haven't read yet, but Bruce Gleason put me onto that, and it sounds very good.
I have a copy of that, but it's, and my wife's read it, but it's a few years back.
Mm. Oh, yes, it goes back quite a way.
Not a very long book, but interesting. It's one of those ones again. Look, must get to that. Who does? Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Let's talk about the ones
talk about the ones we've actually gotten to, eh?
Well, we've actually read, hopefully.
Yes.
We're assuming that we've read them. We may have got halfway through them and chucked them out, but I can tell you that I haven't done that. Of all the ones I'm going to talk about today, I have actually read and enjoyed.
So have I. Okay.
Good.
All right. So my first book is Ithaca by Claire North. Now, this is quite a change of direction from Claire North, whose books Perry and I both like a lot. Now, we should start by saying that Claire North is a nom de plume for Catherine Webb, which is her real name. Her first novels that she published as Claire North are, they're, what would you call them, intriguing thrillers with a series of very strange concepts, such as her first book under that name, The First 15 Lives of Harry August, which we talked about quite a lot on the podcast. And I suppose you could call them fantasy, but they're very unusual fantasies. Anyway, to get back to Ithaca. Here she's written an excellent piece of what you could call historical fiction with some gentle fantasy elements, I suppose. Not a lot, actually, interestingly. This is all based on Greek mythology. I was just going to start by saying when I was growing up in England and raiding my local library as often as I could, Greek myths and legends were what you might call grown-up fantasies, which I encountered. Once I've moved past, you know, books like Enid Blyton and Edith Nesbit and those sort of authors. And I was quickly fascinated by these myths. So here were tales of heroes like Theseus and Perseus, Jason and the Argonauts, Achilles, Heracles, and of course, excerpts from the wanderings of Odysseus. And all of these were tailored for a younger audience because I found them in the children's library. And so the the sort of more robust sexual exploits of Zeus were omitted or watered down. And overwhelmingly, these tales were presented from a male point of view, dealing with male heroes, and mostly dealing with what happened to the male gods, such as Zeus, Ares, Poseidon, and Hermes, with Athena perhaps being an exception because of her renown with arms. But, as Clay North points out early on in Ithaca, the poets who wrote of these gods and heroes were themselves almost certainly male. Either that or it's only the writings of men which have survived. But what about the stories of the wives, of the widows, of the mothers and the daughters? Surely theirs is no less a valid point of view, and probably a much more accurate point of view, as male poets tend to elaborate the truth in the aid of telling a good story. So, in this book, the author focuses on those left behind on the small island of Ithaca, after its king Odysseus and his men have left for the war with Troy. 18 years have passed since all the adult men left, and now the inhabitants of Ithaca are either old men or young people, or young men who have grown up without their fathers. And, of course, the women. In particular, the book focuses on Penelope, Odysseus's queen, struggling with keeping Ithaca going, while at the same time having to fend off a horde of would-be suitors, each certain that Odysseus is dead, and each keen to marry Penelope and become king of this small realm. So this book, which is the first of a projected trilogy, is narrated by the goddess Hera, Zeus's wife. She's the goddess of wives and mothers. Her attitude in the book towards her fellow gods is a sharp and cynical one. She has some very snide things to say about Athena. But her interest in visiting Ithaca secretly without Zeus's knowledge is to watch Penelope's struggles and to assist where she can. The book doesn't open with Penelope, though, and this unruly crowd of suitors, but with an attack on a small fishing village by three ships of raiders who pillage, burn, and rape. One of the few survivors of this attack is a young woman, Theodora, who has the sense to flee. Her would-be boyfriend, Dares, tries to fight the raiders, and they quickly kill him. Now, this isn't the first such raid. There have been a couple of previous raids like this, and it's clear that there's likely to be more of these each time the moon is full. Penelope knows that she's got to do something, but she's surrounded by male counsellors, all of them these old men, and they're all old and feeble. And she's just a woman, queen or not, and it's difficult for her to have her voice heard. The old men want to try to put together a militia to fight the raiders, but all they have to work with is to put together this militia are other old men and a number of these untrained youths, among them who's Telemachus, Odysseus' own son. Much of the novel relates to Penelope's ongoing fears for Telemachus, who's grown up in his absent father's heroic shadow and is desperately trying to live up to what he feels are others' expectations of him. The little militia put together by the old men is far too short of numbers, weapons, and skill to put up much of a fight against these raiders, even though Telemachus has been getting some additional training at the hands of an Egyptian who's joined the suitors. Penelope, however, has been secretly putting in place another approach, building an army of her own. I'm just going to quote this little exchange, which I thought was really nice. One of these old counsellors says to her, "How do you hide an army?" "Medon," Penelope tuts, "what a foolish question. You hide them in precisely the same way that you hide your success as a merchant, your skill with agriculture, your wisdom at politics, and your innate cutting wit. You hide them as women." Then there's a twist with the arrival on Ithaca of three black-sailed ships bearing news of the death of Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae, who was the leader of the victorious Greek forces at Troy. On board the ships are Agamemnon's children, Orestes and Electra. They're here not only to bear the news, but to try to find Clytemnestra, their mother, who murdered Agamemnon. Orestes feels compelled to swear to kill her in revenge, but in the novel, he's largely a puppet in the hands of his implacable sister, Electra. This makes life very much harder for Penelope, who's Clytemnestra's cousin, because Penelope knows that Clytemnestra has indeed fled to Ithaca, and she eventually discovers where she's hiding. So I thought this feminist treatment of this part of Greek myth was very convincing. All of the most active roles and viewpoints in the novel are those of women, both human women and female gods. And this viewpoint seems both fresh and perfectly natural. if I'm going to be critical at all, it's only to say that there were times when the narration by the goddess Hera felt a little bit too contrived. Now, I felt at times it would have been better to have had the story told directly by Penelope. And I occasionally had to remind myself that it was Hera, not Penelope, who was talking. So I won't try to outline any more of the story. I've already gone on long enough, which, although it starts fairly slowly, it quickly gathers pace and becomes gripping. So I liked it a lot, and I'm looking forward to the other books in the trilogy, each of which will be narrated by a different goddess. So looking forward to that. There you go.
Okay, that really sounds interesting.
It is.
There's a book around, as we've probably mentioned in the past, The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell. There was a new book published last year called The Heroine with a Thousand and One Faces, which I have a copy of, which I must go and have a look at. And that deals with the idea of storytelling from the women's point of view and tries to bring that back up into consideration by a lot of people. Mm. And it's a very valid point that you make, in the sense that a lot of the myths and legends were written by men and show from the men's perspective. And we're not getting the women's points of view very much at all. So this sounds very good.
It is.
It's interesting. And it actually slides very, very well into my first book, which is called The Visitor by Maeve Brennan, which is purely and simply about women. There are no men characters in this book at all. There are some that are mentioned, but they never appear on stage. Now, this is a very interesting and... Well, so the publishing history of this particular book is very interesting. Firstly, it's a novella. It's only about 120 pages long. And I sat down and I just read this in one sitting. I started it and couldn't stop. Because I thought it was just such a wonderful book. Now, it was first written by Irish writer Maeve Brennan when she'd been when she was living in the US. She moved there in about the 1930s, I think, basically forced her way into, well, not forced her way into, but made herself available to be able to work at a publishing house, and then gradually... worked her way through to be working on staff at the New Yorker. She used to write a lot of small little pieces called The Talk of the Town, which may not necessarily have been published under her name. I can't really tell you. I'm not an aficionado of the New Yorker magazine. But she had a big, very good reputation as being a great writer. But she didn't write very much in the way of fiction. This particular novella was written in the 1940s, passed along to a publisher, and then for whatever reason, it just wasn't picked up, and wasn't published, and was left languishing in their archives. Those archives got donated to a university somewhere in the US, and when a researcher went in to have a bit of a look at the what was there, came across this novella and was quite taken with it. So it wasn't actually published until 2001, some 60 years after it was first written. Now, this is a stunning piece of work, David. It is really, really good. Now, for whatever reason, I'd known of Maeve Brennan's name, and for the life of me, I can't remember where I ever heard it. And I was down the library and I happened to be wandering along and I saw this curious little book and I pulled it out and I thought, I know this woman's name. Where do I know this woman's name from? No idea. Oh, well, it's only short. I'll take it out and read it. So I had it in the pile of books I had from the library, and I was listening to one of my favourite podcasts when I was going out for a walk, and that is a podcast by the name of Backlisted. Now, I don't know whether you're aware of this one, but it's a couple of literary types in the UK whose aim is to bring to the fore books from the backlist, older books that may have been forgotten. Everybody talks about what's new and what's up and coming, but not many people, we do, but not a lot of other people, talk about older books and books that may have been neglected. And they actually decided to talk about a collection of short stories by none other than Maeve Brennan. So I listened to this, and everybody on the podcast, because they normally have the two main guests and they have two main hosts, and two, sometimes three guests, and everybody absolutely raved about this woman's work. So I thought, right, that's it. Moved it right up the top of the to-be-read list. And, of course, you've also got the point that you've only got 3 weeks to read it from the library, so that cracked the whip a bit. And up I go, and I started reading it, and I'm glad I did. Anyway, to give you a bit of a background, it's set in Dublin. When's it set? Well, probably about the 1940s. So let's say just after the war, the Second World War. 22-year-old Anastasia King has returned to her grandmother's house in Dublin after she'd been living for a number of years in Paris with her mother. Her mother had separated from her grandmother's son, and the grandfather came back to Dublin. The mother went to Paris. And the idea was that they were going to stay there a few years and then come back to Ireland again. But they never did. They never came back. And in the end, the mother dies. And Anastasia, who basically has no experience of life at all, is left a little bit bereft, doesn't know what to do. So she contacts her grandmother and says, "Can I come and stay with you?" The grandmother says, yeah, sure, okay. Thinking that Anastasia is going to come and stay for a month, 2 months, something like that. And then she's going to move on. But that's not what Anastasia thinks. Anastasia thinks she's there and she's just going to move in forever. But the major problem that Anastasia finds when she gets to this particular house is her grandmother doesn't really like her, hated her mother because her mother took her son away from her and was the cause of his, or the son's come back to Dublin and died some years before. So the grandmother's house is completely in a state of mourning and has been for like 10 years. And it stayed that way. And the grandmother basically just keeps everything locked up pretty much. She's got one servant, never leaves the house, just stays in the house the whole time. This is sort of really depressing. And, there's this, it's just, there's over, it's almost gothic in its sense of just this overwhelming sort of atmosphere of, resentment and loss and grief and longing and sorrow for things that are no longer there. And that the grandmother's life is just based on this idea of longing and sorrow that her son isn't around anymore. And Anastasia is sort of the thing in her face all the time that reminds her of her son is no longer around. So, of course, she doesn't really like her very much. And so this is really a story about how Anastasia is trying to find her own way in the world and also trying to basically get on her grandmother's good side, which is, of course, as you can tell right from the very beginning, is a complete waste of time because the grandmother's going to have absolutely nothing to do with this. But it's just beautifully and simply written. And it's hard to really describe how well this is done, because if you were to choose anything from this particular book, you really wouldn't get much of an idea that the writing was all that flash. But it just flows beautifully. It's a very easy style, but there's a lot going on. And after a while, you start realizing while you're getting a sort of a surface layer of what's happening, there's a lot going on underneath this. And you start to wonder about Anastasia's mental health and the state that she's in. Is it being exacerbated by the grandmother, or was always there? It's hard to tell. So things are very much, they look on the surface, you'd read this and go, oh, this is a pretty boring book, but it's got a lot going on. There's a lot moving around underneath, and it's really a small gem of a work, this. And it's a really pity that there's only another two short story collections and a collection of her writings from the New Yorker to go. And that's it. There were no novels, no plays, nothing. And we're lucky we've got this one. But so I can recommend this one. I gave this one 4.6 out of 5. It's a very fairly high score. So in other words, I gave 5 stars, if you like, because you rounded it up. It's called The Visitor by Maeve Brennan, and I can hardly recommend it.
Yeah, it sounds very good indeed. Yes, you're right that, is it the Cemetery of Lost Books? So there's someone writes about that. The books that are forgotten, but don't deserve to be forgotten.
So, yep.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, well, I'm going to talk about a book which certainly hasn't been forgotten, even though it was written 30 years ago. and that's The Secret History by Donna Tartt. Now, Donna Tartt's a curious author, I think, because she's only published three novels, spaced close to evenly every 10 years for the last 30 years. Every one of those novels received overwhelming praise when it came out, and two of them won several prestigious awards. The Secret History was her debut novel, published in 1992. That was followed by The Little Friend in 2002. And her most recent book was The Goldfinch, published in 2013, which won the Pulitzer Prize. So if she sticks to a once-in-a-decade schedule like this, we can at least hope that we're due for another one any moment now. Let's hope so. So The Secret History is astonishingly good for a first novel. I started to read this book in a library copy, but I ran out of time and had to return it. It's a very thick book. But I'd read enough by then to know that I wanted to own my own copy, and so I went out and bought a copy, a hardcover, of the recently released 30th anniversary edition published by Viking. It's not an easy book to describe. One way might be to say that it's a highly literate crime novel. Yes, it's about crime, but there's no mystery involved. The prologue tells you immediately that the first-person protagonist and a group of his friends killed someone called Bunny by pushing him off a cliff into a ravine in the mountains. Who these people are, what the lead-up to this situation was, why they killed Bunny, and what in particular were the consequences of the murder, fill up the rest of this very long book. It's 629 pages long in this edition. That's very long, but there was never a moment when I was reading it when it flagged or I became tired of reading it. It just kept me going. It certainly fits more into the category of literary fiction than genre crime fiction, not only because of the quality of the writing, which in my view is outstanding, but because of its high level of its concerns about society, about love, about education, about crime, shame and guilt. More than anything, it's about young people trying to make sense of themselves and the world. It's just so good all around. So I'll try to encapsulate the plot quickly. Well, at least the setup of the plot. So the book's set in a small college in a town in Vermont in the United States, and the period must be around the early 1980s. And our first-person protagonist is Richard Pappen, P-A-P-E-N, who's a 19-year-old Californian, and he transfers to Hampton College after deciding that he isn't suited to becoming a doctor. In his pre-med course, however, he studied ancient Greek, and he'd done very well in it. So he wants to continue his studies at Hampton. However, here he finds that the Greek course is run by an eccentric tutor, Julian Morrow, who accepts very few students. The semester's already well advanced, and so far there are only five students studying under Julian. These are the twins Charles and Camilla, Francis, Henry, and Edmund, or Bunny. Now, after some resistance from Julian, Richard is eventually accepted by him as a student, and so he comes to class and is very slowly befriended by these other students of Greek, who formed a very tight group amongst themselves. The intense relationships between this group of six people and their tutor are the central focus of the book. So this is the core of the plot. At a time when Richard is still something of an outsider, the others, seized by fascination with Julian's account of divine madness in Greek literature, try to invoke the same thing, try to invoke a Dionysian frenzy using drugs. During one such attempt, while their friend Bunny is absent, they do succeed in achieving that frenzied state. But in the process, they accidentally kill the farmer on whose land that they've strayed. From this one awful incident, the rest of the plot flows. It isn't a particularly complex plot. Suffice it to say that all of those involved in the first incident and then the murder of Bunny are trapped by their knowledge and fear of discovery. Richard, in particular, who's had no direct hand in these deaths, can't escape. So I've said that the quality of the writing is outstanding. There's just some arresting prose. It's one of those books which, as I was reading, I just kept stopping to admire the way the writing had been done. You know, a particular sentence, a particular phrase. That doesn't happen often with books that I read, but it was that way here. So I can't resist several quotes. So here's the first one. This is a description of Charles and his twin sister, Camilla. side note here, Charles and Camilla being a common couple name at the moment, it seems a bit confusing, but this is well before the current King Charles. Anyway, so here's a description of Charles and his twin sister Camilla. Side by side, they are very much alike, in similarity less in lineament than of manner and bearing, a correspondence in gesture which bounced and echoed between them, so that a blink seemed to reverberate moments later in a twitch of the other's eyelid. Oh, this one, which I think is just a perfect sentence. Richard is falling in love with Camilla. So this, here's the quote. The light from the window was streaming directly into her face. In such strong light, most people look somewhat washed out. But her clear, fine features were only illuminated until it was a shock to look at her pale and radiant eyes with their sooty lashes, at the gold glimmer at her temple that blended gradually into her glossy hair, warm as honey. Imagine being able to write a sentence like that. You know, as a writer, I'm in awe. This is the last quote, you'll be pleased to know. Late in the book, after Bunny's body is discovered, after the heavy snowfalls which have been hiding it, and they've begun to melt. So this, just late in the book. I never got used to the way the horizon there could just erase itself and leave you marooned adrift in an incomplete dreamscape that was like a sketch for the world you knew. The outline of a single tree standing in for a grove, lamp posts and chimneys floating up out of context before the surrounding canvas was filled in. An amnesia land, a kind of skewed heaven where the old landmarks were recognizable but spaced too far apart and disarranged and made terrible by the emptiness around them. You know, writing as good as this just makes reading a joy. I can't praise this book highly enough. Highly, highly recommend it.
I believe I have a copy somewhere in the house. My wife read this some time ago. So yes, okay, all right. Yet another one that's pushed up the list, David.
So I've got a copy of her Goldfinch, the Goldfinch, which I say won the Pulitzer. So that's one of those books that's been pulled out from the back of the shelf and is sitting there at the front, waiting for me to get to.
You can watch it. Read it while you're watching.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think the film was reported to be very, very good. So no, I'd rather read the book.
The Secret History.
I'm thinking of the Goldfinch. There's certainly a film of the Goldfinch.
All right. Okay. All right. Okay. Well, I'm going to move away from 600 page whoppers back to another small novel. This time an Australian novel, probably about 140 pages. Again, one of these ones that you get. Well, I've read in one or two sittings, so this one's quite interesting. It's the it's called Night Blue by Angela O'Keefe, a debut novel from 2021, and it was shortlisted for the UTS Glenda Adams Award for New Writing, which is a part of the New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards last year. Now, this is a strange little book. Because it tells the story of the Jackson Pollock painting Blue Poles, mostly from the point of view of the painting itself.
Okay.
Now, this is a pretty ambitious thing to be doing in a debut novel. And I started reading this and I thought, it starts off, the first sentence is, I began one night in 1952 in a barn on Long Island, New York. And that goes on to describe how Jackson Pollock came to paint Blue Poles. His start, display of the painting, the stop, bringing it back again, redoing it, and working on it. And we slowly get details of, you know, the painting's creation, its sale to private owners, and what it, where it sits in an apartment in New York. And then finally to its purchase by the Australian government in 1973, amid massive controversy and criticism. David, you and I are old enough to remember a lot of this that went on back in 1973. I remember going to see it when it was toured around Australia, and I was living in Adelaide. I went to the Art Gallery of South Australia and saw it there. And if I remember rightly, it actually had an armed guard.
Yes, because it was very controversial. Yeah.
It was very controversial because the Australian government paid $1.3 million for it. And this was unheard of. Nobody had ever paid $1.3 million for a modern piece of art, a piece of modern art. I mean, people were aghast. How dare they? They could build a hospital for this. It's the same old story again, you know, that whenever something comes up that they don't like, they always think, you could spend this money on this or you spend this money on that. Well, the Australian government, under Gough Whitlam at that time, stuck to their guns and said, nah, this is it, we're going to keep it, that's it, no problem, there it is. And it's now part of the Australian landscape in some ways. I mean, I know it sits in National Gallery in Canberra, and is not always displayed to its best advantage. Last time I was in Canberra about a year, 18 months ago, before I'd read this book, I wanted to go and see it. And it wasn't on display at all. It was off somewhere. They were doing the room up. And anyway, it was only in a very smallish room without a very high ceiling at all. And just, that doesn't strike me as being the spot for it. It needs to be, it's a big piece of work, meters long and 2 or 3 meters high. It really needs to have a big wall. Mm. And you need to be able to stand back and just take it all in. Now, a lot of people think it's a load of crap, you know, oh, my son could do this, you know, my two-year-old could do this. Well, I'm sorry to tell you, your two-year-old could not do this, this painting. You may think that they might have done something similar to it, but no. Now, I'm not a big aficionado of modern art, and so I can't really tell you where it fits in the modern pantheon, but it is a stunning piece of work. I actually quite like it.
Yeah, I've seen it.
I go along to it and I go, hey, yeah, okay, I can see some form and structure here, and I really like it. Mm. And you may find that when you're reading this particular book, if you don't like the piece of work, art, you may not like this book. I don't know. But let me tell you, telling a story from the point of view of a piece of art is, as I said, ambitious. So it's told in three particular sections. The first part is the painting narrator describing the creation and all the way right through to the initial purchase by the Australian government, the initial display and exhibition around the country. And then, I don't know if you recall, David, but actually at that time in 1973, there was no National Gallery as it stands at the moment in Canberra. That had to be built, and maybe the purchase of Blue Poles was a bit of a kicker for that National Gallery to be built in Canberra. But the painting was stuck in a storage facility for about 7 or 8 years until the gallery was actually completed and then dragged out and placed on display. So anyway, so that's the first section. And in that first section, the painting is visited before it goes into storage or when it is in storage by two art restorers who come in to check to see that everything's going okay, that it's not deteriorating. Because, of course, the art materials that a lot of modern painters use is a bit transitory, and sort of some of the paint is not really going to last all that long. It could flake off. So they just wanted to make sure that everything was going okay. The second section of this book is told from the point of view of one of those two art restorers, a young woman who is researching Blue Poles and has gone to the US to do a fair bit of research on it because she wants to determine whether or not the painting was done wholly and solely by Jackson Pollock or whether there was another person in the room at some point helping out. I don't know why this is a major point, but it seems to have been a fairly strong criticism of the painting that he didn't do it on his own.
Oh, so that's crazy. I mean, a lot of old masters had assistants with, you know, to help them along.
Exactly. Who cares? But anyway, so but it's an interesting piece because it allows you to dig more into the background and also moves away from the painting sitting in Canberra to the US and deals with Pollock's wife and his life in terms of where he was and where everything was painted and where he was exhibiting his work. The third section comes back to the painting again, and it's back to dealing with ruminations on art, politics, and feminism. This is a very interesting piece of work. It could have fallen absolutely and utterly flat on its face if it hadn't been done properly. But I was actually fairly intrigued with this. And the good thing about it is it doesn't go on too long. It's really, as I said, about 150, 160 pages, and then it's done. And it's the story's told. And I thought, I'm really glad that there's an author who hasn't decided, well, I'm really onto a good thing here. I'm just going to keep expanding this and just keep on going. If it had gone to 200-300 pages, I would have started to get pretty bored, I think. There's enough here without there being too much, and it just fits just about right. I think it was probably a little bit over-ambitious to be doing this first off, and I actually thought that she depicted the painting in the first section as being a little bit too sort of easygoing, laissez-faire. I would have liked to have been a bit more of, it's a young child coming up to being a teenager and they're locked in their room. I would have liked to have seen the painting get really, really bloody annoyed about being locked away. I mean, I want to be out here being on display and I'm stuck in this dark room, but she sort of just flows over that. And I would have thought that a bit of anger would have been really good because that would have suited the painting itself as well. But that's just my perspective. So I gave it 3.6 out of 5. I still think this is a book that is worthwhile reading, and basically it pretty much got ignored when it came out in 2021. I hadn't heard of it. And again, it was another one I found at the library and I thought, oh, it's a nice blue colour. I wonder what this one is.
Books sometimes,
and pulled it out.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes you just pull it out and go, Night Blue. Yeah. Oh, that's a nice title. I wonder, oh, this must be a horror novel. You know, you go to have a look at it and goes, well, what? It's about blue poles. Okay, better read this.
Okay.
So I'd recommend it.
Oh, interesting, interesting. Well, okay. All right, so I'm going to talk about my next book, which is The High House by Jesse Greengrass. Start again. The High House by Jesse Greengrass. Now, my wife put me onto this book. She'd listened to it as an audiobook. She listens to a lot of audiobooks while she knits. And she kept nagging me to borrow this from the library and read it. I'm glad she persisted. It's very good. So it's a very sad, what we say, elegiac novel about the forthcoming climate disaster that we're slipping into. And that sad, seemingly inevitable slipping is part of the whole point of this book. A slow-motion catastrophe is happening before our eyes because most of us humans can't quite imagine our comfortable lives really being under threat. So the book could be categorized simply as post-apocalyptic fiction, but unlike many such books, the apocalypse here isn't a sudden dramatic one. It's just this slow, steady decline into catastrophe, which is an all too likely scenario. It's all about change and how we struggle to deal with it. Change both slow and rapid, all too often very slow at first, and then very rapid. So published in late 2021, The High House is certainly up to date and prescient. One key event is the destruction of much of Florida by a powerful hurricane. Sound familiar? The High House is narrated by three point of view characters, Caro, for short for Carolyn, and Sally, who are in their late teens as the story begins, and Paulie, a boy who is only a toddler at that point. So Caro is the daughter of a climate scientist. He and Caro's stepmother, Francesca, spend much of their time attending conferences and agitating for action on climate change. Francesca, in particular, is passionate and furious about the lack of action against the disaster she sees looming. But despite her fears for the future, she becomes pregnant. Others in the environmental movement criticize her harshly for this. They think this baby is an admission of defeat, Francesca says. But Caro says, I'm going to quote, "But watching her, I thought that it was not defeat at all. Rather, it was a kind of furious defiance that had led her to have a child, despite all that she believed about the future. A kind of pact with the world that having increased her stake in it, she should try to protect what she had found to love." The birth is very difficult and the baby struggles for life during its early weeks. But once it's clear that Paul, or Paulie, will survive, Francesca makes plans for him. Over the years, she essentially builds him an ark. Not a ship, but a house, the High House. The High House is an old house which Francesca has bought and set on a rise in a rural area near the coast of England. She spends a great deal of money and time, much of it kept secret from young Caro, to renovate the house and its surrounds to make it as resilient and self-contained as she can. After Francesca and Caro's father are killed in Florida by a massive hurricane, Caro follows the instructions that she's been left, and she leaves their apartment in London and takes Paulie to the High House. But things have already started to fall apart in England, making this a difficult and exhausting journey. At the end of it, she has to abandon their bags and carry Paulie for miles on her back. But when Caro eventually arrives at the High House, she's exhausted, expecting it to be empty. She's disconcerted to find Sally and Sally's grandfather, Grandy, already living there. But they're there at Francesca's request. As Sally comments when she sees Caro's resentment of her being there, she says, "Francesca needed me too and Grandy. What would Caro have done in the High House by herself? How would she have dug the garden, lived, looked after Paulie? It is not enough to have an ark if you do not also have the skills to sail it." So, but despite its important underlying environmental theme, the core of the book is really about character, about the interpersonal relationships between Caro and Sally and their mutual love of young Paulie, for whose affections they for a while jealously contend. Often we see a scene through Caro's eyes, immediately followed by Sally's view of the same event, and vice versa. Then we might get young Paulie's take on the same thing. Each of these characters has considerable depth and interest. Meanwhile, in the outer world, things are steadily getting worse. The sea is rising and storms bring flooding rains. Summer lasts now for 9 months of the year. Winters are still cold, but rain is much more frequent. Coastal cities are becoming uninhabitable, and many people have become reluctant climate refugees. The High House is well away from regular roads and pathways, however, and can't be seen from the road. Otherwise, Caro and Sally might find themselves having to make hard decisions about how many people their small plot of land could possibly support. Francesca has chosen its location well. Life at the High House also becomes increasingly fragile as the stores Francesca has gathered are slowly depleted as the years pass. Grandy, who is already an old man as the story opens, grows feeble and can't help the young women as they struggle to grow crops for themselves. There's no possible medical help, so they have to be doubly careful not to injure themselves or to let Paulie come to harm. There are still people eking out a living in the rest of England, but it's a hard, endless struggle against cold and hunger. Caro, Sally and Paulie have been given a head start by the foresight of Francesca, but perhaps that only means that they'll just take longer than anyone else to die. Sally looks back towards the end of the book. I just want to quote this. "Somehow, while we'd all been busy, while we'd been doing these small things which added up to living, the future had slipped into the present, and, despite the fact that we had known that it would come, the overwhelming feeling, now that it was here, was of surprise, like waking up one morning to find that you had been young, and now, all at once, you weren't." Another beautiful sentence there, by the way. Very good writing here. I thought this was a very impressive and moving book, sounding a grim warning, and it doesn't give any easy answers. Well worth reading.
Did this get many notices when it came out?
I don't think it did. It just Sue brought my attention to it.
Well, it's interesting because I'd heard about it separately. One of the guys on Backlisted was raving about it. He had said that he'd been handed it by a friend and told to read it, and was very glad that he had. So it's good to hear that you thought it was good as well. But it's just one of those ones that sounds like it might be one of those almost genre adjacent, but
yeah,
because it's sort of speculative into the future and with the climate change background. Mm. Sounds interesting.
Yes, very good.
Sounds interesting. Mm. Okay, well, for my last section offering, I'm going to be talking about a book called A Bookshop in Algiers by Katha Adimi. This was originally published in French in 2017 and was translated by Chris Andrews and published in English in 2020. Now, I'd never heard of Katha Adimi prior to this. She was born in Algiers in 1986 and has lived in Paris since 2009 and sort of lives and works there. Now, this tells the story of oddly enough, a bookshop in Algiers, which was opened in 1936 by a man by the name of Edmond Charlot, who was actually a real character. And this sort of follows his life in Algiers from the time that he decides that he wants to open this small bookshop with very, very little money. But he gradually builds it up until it just goes right through to the present time, from 1936 to 2017, anyway, 80 years later. So it's told in two parts. Firstly, there's the following the notebooks and diaries and journals of Charlot from about 1935 to 1961, as he expands his bookshop and his interest in book publishing, meeting up and working with Albert Camus, and being drafted into the army during the Second World War, and finally ending up living and working in Paris, because that's where his publishing business ends up taking him. The second stream details a young man, French man, by the name of Riad, who has taken on the job of an internship. He has to do a job over summer for his studies, and his uncle gets him in touch with somebody in Algiers who wants to clear this bookshop out. Of course, it's the same bookshop that we're talking about that Edmond Charlot opened. And so he flies from Paris to Algeria and starts working on clearing out the bookshop, getting rid of all of the materials that are there. And it's just basically stuff that seems to have been sitting there for 40 or 50 years untouched. And it deals with his interactions with the bookshop's community, that is, the people that live in and around the area, none of whom seem to be particularly interested in books at all, but are very nostalgic for the bookshop itself. They like having the bookshop there, even though they would never think about going and reading or reading any books. And it just seems to be that there's a underlying current here in the background that the people in Algeria not reading very many books at all. I mean, they will read newspapers and magazines and read stuff on their phones, but are not actually picking up books and reading them. Why that is, it's not really gone into. But the people in the community just really like the idea of having a bookshop in their row of shops with the restaurants all around them. But it's not making any money. And the person that's bought this building has decided the bookshop needs to be cleared out. He wants it, all of the material gone, donated wherever he possibly can, get rid of it, clear everything out, put everything out to the garbage and whitewash all the walls so that he can turn it into a restaurant, which is a bit, it's got a sad process to it. But it's really a story about a man who will do anything for his love of books. And for the people who read and write them, because he sets up, this is Charlot, sets up his own little community around this particular bookstore. Of course, he gets into trouble with the authorities because some of the pieces that are being written that he's publishing are considered to be a little bit politically difficult for the government, you know, might be a little bit critical about what it is they're doing. And so he keeps on running into trouble with them and having difficulty in actually finding paper during the Second World War and then ink as well. And so it makes things fairly difficult for him. But it's a loving indication of what somebody will do and how they will start off with an idea about a bookshop and then that leads to a publishing venture. And it just basically takes over this man's life. And he just is always coming back to it, trying to work out how he can get back to publishing these small editions that's all he can afford of some small pieces by authors that he really likes, and trying to get them to the people that he thinks will read them, buy them, and then read them. But having been thwarted all the way right through. But it's also a bit of a story about the colonial attitudes of mid 20th century. French governments cajoling the Algerians into coming and fight for the mother country and saying that, you know, when the war is over, they will be remembered. Yeah, they were remembered all right. well, yeah, we remember you now, but we've forgotten you now. And so it goes all the way through to the big uprising in Algeria in the 1950s and shows a bit of that as well. So you get a bit of a Algerian perspective on the French governments and their colonial views, which is always interesting to see because you don't get this terribly often. Certainly you don't get it in sort of English books originally written in English.
Or presumably in French.
Or presumably in French very often. But I think maybe they're starting to come. There's probably more books coming out now about this, but this is about a man's love affair with books and publishing. And that's worthwhile for that. But you can also read it for a view of colonial North Africa and its intellectual communities in the 30s and 40s. And just read it if you like books. This one, 3.9 out of 5. Another one I picked up at the library because I thought, oh, well, bookshop in Algiers, that looks pretty interesting. I haven't read anything from that part of the world for a long period, if ever. And I was quite taken with it.
Sounds very good.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Indeed.
So I think we're done.
I think we might wind up, but I thought we could perhaps just quickly mention some of the other books I've been reading, just very quickly.
Yeah, surely. What have you got that you've read?
Well, I'll only just mention their names, really, but I read a very interesting, very long book, science fiction book called Psalms for the End of the World by Cole Haddon. Which I got onto because I saw this guy talking about his book on Twitter, and he very kindly sent me a copy. But he sent me a copy in PDF format, which was a bit of a struggle to read. But it's very interesting. So I won't talk about it now. But it was very interesting. I read also a very interesting but not pleasant to read book, non-fiction book by Grace Tame, her autobiography, if you like, or story of her life so far. It's a weird title. It's called The Ninth Life of a Diamond Miner. But it's about her, sexual assault by her teacher when she was only 15 years old, and her teacher was 58 years old and groomed and raped her. Terrible. But it's an important book to read, I think. And a crime novel called The Unbelieved by Vicky Petraitis, which has some of the same themes. So that's my kind of collection of books I haven't talked about yet on the podcast and probably will never get the chance to, but I just thought I'd mention them as we went by.
Oh, I think we might. I think we might be able to put a couple of these non-fiction books into episodes coming up
next year.
I mean, I've got the one that I thought we might have time to talk about, but we don't this time. Mountains of the Mind by Robert McFarlane. I spoke about Underland, his book from a couple of years ago. And this is his first book, Mountains of the Mind. It tells the story of how mountaineering became to be this overwhelming enthusiast for so many people. And it gives the whole history and based on the fact that he's a mountaineer, and I really love the way that he writes, and really is very evocative. And I'll talk about that one later.
Okay.
I've also, recently read Travels with My Aunt by Graham Greene, which I found very, very amusing. It's a very, very interesting look at that side of England that was slowly disappearing in the late 1960s, and those people that had been there from all the way right through from the start of the century, and how they were struggling to adapt to what was happening around them. That was good. I enjoyed that one a lot. I also picked up a book by Greg Bear. We mentioned last episode that he had recently passed away. And I was looking at this and realised that I was rather embarrassed to understand or to note that I don't think I'd ever read anything by him.
No.
So I picked up a book called Hull 03, which is a Generation Starship novel. Always interested to see what people do with Generation Starships. This one's sort of okay. I only gave it 3 out of 5. I think it's a bit overly long in places and just keeps going on and on and on. But you know, it's it covers one of those things that can go wrong on a generation starship, and handles it pretty well. But I thought I got the impression the author was more interested in the hardware than he was in the story itself. So, you know, so basically, look, it was okay and it was pleasant, but I didn't think it was one of the best books of the year. But there we go.
All right. Okay.
So, so that's it. I think we're done.
Well, speaking of best books of the year, we're going to take a break now, and we'll come back with our best books of 2022, won't we? That'll be our first episode, which will be mid-January, what do you reckon?
Yes, mid-January, and then we'll follow up with best film and television. That will be mainly me, more than David.
You, let me tell you.
Although, David, you have watched some stuff this year that you've told me some stuff that you've really liked.
On end when our television literally does not get turned on, let me tell you.
That's fine, but there are a couple of seasons of stuff that you can talk about.
All right,
which,
we'll see.
I'm sure
we'll
that
see.
You've watched that I haven't seen, and some things that I have seen that you have also seen because you've watched them on my recommendation told me about this. So we can talk about those, and that's what we'll be talking about in mid-January. We're taking our normal end-of-year break, having a bit of a gap between now and our next one, but we'll be back in mid-January with our best books.
That'll be a very interesting and long episode, I reckon, that one.
2022.
It'll be some very interesting stuff I read this year. Very good stuff.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. Righto, David.
Okay, we'll leave it at that.
Have a good end of year. Merry Christmas, happy holidays, and any other salutation that you would like to hear. I hope that everybody enjoys themselves over the end of year period and come back refreshed.
Indeed.
And back into it again in January.
Okay. Indeed. All right. Okay. Thanks for that. See you then.
See you then.
Okay.